Hello, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 189 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, we're chatting with a good friend of mine, Scott Kelly. He's the cyclocross manager for Team Canada, works for Norco Factory Team. He's on the board of directors of Cycling Canada, and he's a really good road trip partner on top of it all. It was great to catch up with Scott. We got into a lot of stuff that I think you guys are going to be interested in, you know, our normal discussion on what cyclocross is going to look like in the future, but also some mountain biking history and stories in there as well. This conversation took place May 27th. I've been hanging on to it because after it happened is when the George Floyd murder occurred, and there were a lot of more important things that I think we should have been concentrating on were happening. And we, on this show, if you go back and look at the other episodes with Adam Austin and Tobin, some more timely conversations that we wanted to have. So I hung on to that, the conversation I had with Scott, until now. So some of this may seem a little bit dated, but I think for the most part, what we are talking about is evergreen, because heck, it's about USGP and what we're going to do in cyclocross. So we have that conversation every week, so you haven't missed anything. Check out Wide Angle Podium, wideanglepodium.com. We got a ton of content going up. I would love for you all to check it all out. If you are not a member, this is the time. Please sign up. There are a ton of different membership levels. You can look at all of them on the site. We want you to be a part of this community. Also, check out all of the stuff the Wide Angle Podium is doing on YouTube, especially on my channel. If you go to youtube.com/CXHeres, you can see the rough draft and all the other videos we have out there. And if you're looking for some merch, I got all of mine on sale. It's CXHeresDistro.com. Okay, let's get to our conversation with Scott Kelly. We're talking mountain biking, we're talking cyclocross, we're talking Canada, and we're doing that right now. Scott Kelly, if I were to give you the option of both your fingers and your toes, how many of those digits would it take to fill all of the roles, positions, and jobs that you currently hold in cycling?
That's a good question. Certainly more than one hand, I bet. There's a lot of stuff I do that I forget about sometimes.
I say that only because I feel like you do more than it. I mean, I think in cycling, a lot of people wear a lot of different hats, but you amongst many of them, between Team Canada stuff and your own bike shop and Norco stuff, and then filling in for Cliff every once in a while, and then the mountain bike side and the cyclocross side, you see a lot.
I do, but I feel like maybe I'm like, you ever watch the movie Office Space and there's the guy with the red stapler? I feel like I'm that guy, that position in most of these organizations. Exactly. Like, they're trying to push me into the basement and I'm like, but cyclocross.
So you're the Milton of cycling.
I try where I can.
So here's the deal. I've been doing these shows where really trying to steer clear of everything that's going on in the world right now, you know, just being a 6'5" ostrich with my head in the sand. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that'll come up in our conversation, but I'm glad that we're finally having this conversation. And I want to talk to you because you got this long history in both mountain biking and cyclocross. I think people find interesting, and it sort of fits in with a lot of the conversations that I've been having recently. And I want to say that I first came to you, I'm going to say it was either 2015 or 2016. I was like, hey, we have to do a podcast. you got to come on my show. We got to record this. So I'm glad now, 5 years later, that we finally are making this happen.
Yes.
And as you just showed me your phone, I'm glad that you are that this conversation is taking precedence over phone calls you're getting from Jeff Kabush.
We were having a debate this afternoon about something unrelated to the current subject at hand. And as we often do, it's, well, you know, Jeff will know the answer to that. So I like reached out to him. But again, with I'm in the Toronto area and he's in the California area. So I kind of have to play with the time change. I probably called him in the middle of a ride and now he'll be up for a couple more hours. So
yeah, he should be good. Yeah. We won't talk for that long before his bedtime. But yeah, going back, cycling. Talk to me about cycling. Where did you get into this whole sport?
So maybe your listeners know, or maybe they don't, but Ontario, Ontario, Canada, where I'm from, actually has a really robust cycling scene and always has. There's a large British community, a large Italian community. There's always been kind of these large road cycling clubs. And Hardwood Hills, which is just about an hour and a half north of Toronto, has always been a large cross-country ski and mountain bike venue. It's a purpose-built venue. And because of that venue and a lot of the kind of purpose-built venues in the province, we've always had a really robust mountain biking scene that I got into when I was, grade 8, grade 9, something along those lines, and rode for the Hardwood team. And just kind of followed the sport from there. So, you know, you'll always see names from Ontario, whether it's Emily Batty or, well, we'll go back even further. I mean, you know, start with like the Kurt Harnetts of the world and the Steve Bowers of the world, and then move through to the Emily Battys and now the Haley Smiths and Pete DeSeres. It's always been kind of overrepresented in terms of racers at an international level, and because it has such a good cycling community. So I started racing for the Hardwood development team when I was younger, and right around 2003, when I was in university, Hamilton hosted the Road Cycling World Championships. And after that, the Hamilton Cycling Club had a bit of an endowment, and we're sending teams all over to compete in these international races. And Tara Ross, who was riding for Advil Chapstick at the time, got in touch with me and asked if I wanted to be a mechanic at the Women's Tour of PEI. It was the first year that they were doing it. So I said, sure. Loaded all my tools. I don't think I had a tool box back then.
When did the mechanicking start?
The mechanic, well, I started as a mechanic in university, I guess, okay. Like, or after high school. Like, I raced a bit and I was never great, but I ended up detaching my retina in a bike crash in the latter half of high school. And after that, you know, recreationally raced, but didn't really seriously race, and was still interested in bikes and still interested in the mechanical side of things. And ended up working at a shop. And I didn't feel like that shop offered the type of, mentorship and learning opportunities to become really good at that craft. And, I remember doing a bit of research and coming up with the United Bicycle Institute in Ashland, Oregon. And so I applied to that and got in, and, I loaded all my belongings into my little 96 Ford Ranger and drove out to Ashland for the summer. And, took the courses and did a bunch of riding on the way back, and then kind of parlayed that into a job at a better bike shop. And then working at that shop and kind of racing a little bit of cyclocross and road, got noticed by, you know, it's just a community thing, right? You find someone who can fix bikes and is willing to do it. And as I say, I loaded all my tools and my stand into a duffel bag, and I took the Red Eye Greyhound to Montreal, and got there at like 6 in the morning, and the tour of Grand Montreal just finished up. And I then got on another bus with the whole all the teams and all the management, and we took that bus to PEI, and I did a stage race with the team. And because of that, I then was able to get a job with the Ontario Cycling Association, working for their provincial team for a couple of years. And around that time, that would have been 2008, Cycling Canada was an Olympic year, but it was also the I don't know the whole backstory, but basically like cycling associations blow themselves up and rebuild every 10 years or so. And it was in a rebuilding period right around the Olympics. So they didn't have a lot of staff to do these secondary and tertiary projects like Pan American Road Championships and Junior Road and Track World. So Denise Kelly, who was my boss at Ontario Cycling, got asked to do Pan American Road and Track Championships in Montevideo, Uruguay. And the team that year was Swain Tuft, Zach Bell, and Dave Veilleux. And we went down there, and they pretty much won everything. And after that, Denise got asked again to do another project for Cycling Canada, which was Junior Road and Track Worlds in Cape Town, South Africa. And at the time, I was working for the Alberta Cycling Association, in a more administrative role. And I asked my boss, I was like, hey, can I take 2 weeks off to go to South Africa? And he was like, absolutely not. Not in the middle of July. That's the height of the race season. That's when we need you at the races. And I'm 22 at the time, or whatever it might be, 23. I was like, when am I ever going to have the chance to go to South Africa in my lifetime, let alone be paid for it? So I quit my job there, loaded all my belongings back into my 96 Ford Ranger, drove back to Ontario, and did Road Nationals with Denise, and drove and went straight from Road Nationals in St. George de Beauce to Junior Road and Track Worlds. And we had a pretty good team that year. We had Leah Kirchman, who now races for Team Sunweb, Hugo Hull, Ryan Aitchison, who won Athens Twilight, Denise Ramsden, who went to the 2012 Olympics for time trial and road. Like it was a bit of a hit squad. Again, did really well. And after that, they started hiring some new coaches. And one of the coaches that I was kind of peripherally involved with was a guy named Dan Prue, who coached Catherine Pendrell at the time. And he was the manager for the 2008 Beijing Olympics. And we had crossed paths because he was working for Cycling BC and I was working for Ontario Cycling. And when he took over the mountain bike program, he called me up and asked if I would be interested in being the mechanic for the mountain bike program. And I said, sure. And that kind of kick-started kind of the last decade or so of my life. I worked for the national team through till 2012 for mountain bike, but also for road. I did road worlds and I did junior road worlds and all that kind of stuff and all these road stage races, along with the mountain bike world cups and the Olympics. And then in 2012 was hired by Scott Three Rocks and started working with Jeff and Aaron Huck and Derek Zanstra, and kind of that brings us up to present.
Yeah. Yeah, going through a number of teams from there up until today with Norco, right?
Yeah, the teams unfortunately keep folding around me.
You were charitable when you were giving federations a 10-year span before they blew everything up and started again. I think with the teams, it's even a less span than that.
Well, the irony now being that 2 years ago, I was nominated to be on the board of directors for Cycling Canada. So now I see the back end of why that is. And as with anything, it's like it's simple answers and simple solutions. It's just getting everyone pointed in the same direction to kind of achieve what everyone wants to do.
All right. Backtracking a little bit.
Yeah.
Best Swain Tuft story that you have.
Swain stories. I don't have any like great ones because I only would have worked with him. I worked with him down in Uruguay.
He's like our Canadian folk hero.
Yeah, absolutely, and he's well deserving. Swain. So at that time, he was racing track and road and time trial. So he's worked. He was on Symmetrics at the time, and Zach was more of a track rider. He had the pedigree, and he ended up racing the 2008 Olympics on the track, but he needed a partner for the Madison and a couple different events. So I just remember watching Swain and Zach race the Madison down there on this outdoor track, and it was just phenomenal. Swain would kind of go long, and everyone would clamor, and like he'd get a lap. And then they'd all like Mark Swain, and then Zach would go for the sprint. So they kept on kind of like playing off each other's strengths. But then they got so good that the whoever was organizing that event started like changing the times and not telling the Canadians or the Americans. And we were in the same hotel. So I remember there was one situation where like I think they missed an event because no one told anyone from North America about the time change. I just remember like Swain's one of those guys who's just like the nicest human being. And I remember I worked with him a little bit with the national team and then a little bit when I did some stuff with Spider Tech. But I remember being in Andorra where he lives for the World Cup. And I was driving down from the venue because it's on the top of a mountain. And I see this guy, kind of muscular dude, pop out of the woods wearing full Orca clothing head to toe on an e-bike. And I'm like, it couldn't be. And I kind of like pull over and I lower my window. And it was Swain. And he comes over and says, "Oh, hey, dude, how you doing?" And I haven't seen him for like, you know, a couple months or a year at that point. He's like, "You got to get yourself one of these e-bikes." And he's like, "Oh, it's made recovery rides so good." Just like cruising through the mountains of Andorra on his like Scott Genius e-bike.
Amazing. Yeah, those teams. Well, it was Symmetrix, is that right?
Symmetrix, yeah. A Norco sponsored team.
That was a killer team. And then that Spider Tech team too.
Mm-hmm. It was there were kind of regional solutions to I think a Canadian problem, which is quite often we have these really, really good riders that people have never heard of. And they stay and they do the Canada Cups and they go through the national team stream where they race their provincial, maybe they race a Quebec Cup and then they move up to the Canada Cup and then they get onto the national team. And then all of a sudden they appear out of nowhere and it takes like the American press by surprise. Whereas everyone has known about them in Canada for, you know, 10 years.
Right.
And I think, the problem with road teams is a lot of the teams, the way they're structured, there's a lot of private money. A lot of the riders have personal sponsors. At one point with like the Division III road teams, there was mandatory ages and you were allowed to have specialists and there was all sorts of things like that. So it really, the Symmetrix team and the folks behind that, and then later Steve Bauer and his program kind of paved the way for a lot of this Canadian talent to kind of hopscotch into the pro tour level by just giving them the opportunity for people to know about them.
Yeah, which is such a you have to be in the know. It seems like there's a ton of talented people out there. It's just getting them in front of the right eyes. Yeah.
It's like the AAA ball or something like that. It's like, we're all like going to like races and like, if you're in the know, you're in the know, as you say, and you know, the next, the gem is coming up and all they need quite often, there's so many people that are so good, but it's just that little opportunity that they need to become a household name.
Yeah.
And then they can take the ball and run with it.
So moving over to mountain biking, what was it that kind of made that stick for you? It seemed that you were starting more road focused.
Yeah. I remember like Dan at one point saying like specifically the reason he hired me is because I was working predominantly on the road and he didn't want anyone with a real, not an affinity but or a bias, but like so much of the way mountain biking is done is a rider will have their mechanic and on a team that can be a bit of a fault. So if I only worked for Katarina, for Cliff, obviously, you know, Catherine or, you know, Hannah or whoever it might be, or Leah might feel like they're being slighted. And within a national team program where you have a bunch of different riders coming together on a regular basis, if there's that feeling of bias, it affects team morale, it affects your ability to do your job. So I think he liked the fact that I was a competent mechanic, but I wasn't necessarily from the scene. And in retrospect, I think that was probably a pretty accurate call. I was able to kind of get in and do the job and be as equitable as possible and as fair as possible amongst all the riders. The Cycling Canada has this weird funding structure where we have what's called enhanced excellence funding. So mountain biking has always received a fair amount of funding because we have this long track record of success, starting with Allison Sider and moving into Chrissy Redden and then moving into Marie-Hélène Permant and then moving into Catherine Pendulum and then Emily Batty and then Haley Smith and onwards. So it's always been a safe bet for the government to fund in hopes of getting medals. And as a mechanic, you're funded to be there for Catherine Pendrell or be there for Jeff Kabush or be there for those medal hopefuls. But the reality of the world is that, you know, when I was young, Jeff had his own mechanic. He was working with Gary Wolf and Catherine was working with Chris Mathis. And I'm certainly there to help those riders in any which way I can. But because they also have pro team staff, and I'm paid to be there for them, well, of course, then we can bring a couple juniors along and a couple of U23s because I have the time to work with them. And I think it's a really great way to work the system is to have that, you know, you're there for the pros, but there's definitely that development aspect of it, which I think having kind of existed in that world for a bunch of years, I kind of bring that kind of thought process to the cyclocross program.
Yeah. And I think what I always enjoyed watching with Dan and the way he runs that team is really the hands-on approach. And I don't think you saw that with this is not a knock, but I'll compare it to the US teams that would show up for mountain bike World Cups. And the thing that I liked that Dan would do is like, he would go out, especially with the younger riders, but with the older ones too. And, you know, they would do what a lot of countries do, where they would stop at every feature and they would just have basically a classroom at every feature, and he'd be running through the lines and running through what you wanted to do and how you wanted to approach it, and then they'd sit there and ride it for an hour and then they'd move on to the next feature of the World Cup course. And I think just what it showed me is that if you're going to spend all the money to send all these people to the best courses in the world and the best competition to give them that true education, there made it that much more valuable.
And I think there's always the balance with that as well, because you're always going to have the elite men and the elite women who don't want to sit around and wait for the junior women and the junior men to kind of figure out a feature. And it's a difficult like job. I know, with the cyclocross program, I really, really, really kind of stress that, you know, we're fresh off the plane over to Europe. We've just built up all the bikes. People are jet lagged. I would absolutely appreciate it. Everyone just did the first lap walking pace, like just go as slow as you possibly can. It's just a spectating lap, right? And I just want you to see the course and get a feel for the course. Ride it as a group. Everyone have your national team kit on. Let's look awesome. Let's just spectate the course. And there's always going to be that one person that ups the pace, and then the other person ups the pace, and then the other person ups the pace. And it's such a struggle to get them to just go slow because they're bike racers, right?
Yeah.
And so it definitely takes some talent to kind of trick the bike racers into riding those features as a group.
it's the ultimate half wheeling.
Oh, absolutely. So and then that's where you have like the assistant coaches that come in, and you have the technical coaches, and you really have to kind of like all go out to those features as groups, but not necessarily if it's easy for the elite women, you don't really want them standing around getting cold while the junior men are trying to master that particular feature. So there's some balances, and that's the kind of the art of coaching is, you know, going to all these different World Cups over the course of, you know, a career and getting a feel for the cadence of the warm up and knowing when you're sticking around for too long and people are getting frustrated, and maybe knowing when you're going too quickly and kind of sensing that before it becomes an issue and moving on and keeping everything up tempo. And I think Dan certainly does a pretty good job at that.
Yeah. And that's also the difference between mountain bike and cyclocross for those instances. I mean, the mountain bike is you still, if you got the pro riders, they're going to be with their they're pro team, and then the federations don't have to worry about them. But then, you know, for your cyclocross team, you kind of got everybody at World Cups, mm-hmm. you know. I guess World Cup's the same. Yeah, I guess it's Worlds is when it's everybody's all under the same, and certainly, the same roof.
We have a really good crop of elite riders in the cyclocross program.
And yeah, I was going to say, like, this year was great. I mean, I was there able to sort of eavesdrop on how you ran it. And I would say that your veterans on there were pretty great in helping everyone out come race day.
And this is an interesting thing, because it took a while for the mountain bike program. Like, we had riders in that program that existed in the previous cohort and were still sticking around. So we had riders coming up through it that were brand new, and you can indoctrinate to a certain extent. But then you had, like, you know, the Jeff Kabushes and the Catherine Pendles and the Max Plaxtons and Seamus McGraths, et cetera, that existed under the previous coach, and maybe like things that he did. And so with the cross program, we're at the point where, like, you know, Mega Lee and Michael Vandenham are kind of our oldest riders, but they've only ever done world championships and world cups in the current kind of program.
Yeah.
And so, and we're very, kind of, clear that, you know, there's an aspirational aspect to it. So even, younger riders like Ruby West, we're very clear with Ruby, you know, younger riders look up to you, be a good role model. And we're going to be there to support you, certainly, but we want you to inspire and help coach the younger riders. And they're all so great with it. Vandenham, absolutely helps lead some of the meetings that we'll do. So we'll turn it over to Mike, and he can kind of talk about his previous experiences at a certain World Cup. Megalee, although she'll stay with by herself, will come out to some of the team dinners and same thing. And she'll lead a lap with the kids. And it's super funny, because Megalee will actually, like, chime in, and she'll go, you know, like, tell me if I'm talking too much. Like, if these kids don't want to hear what I have to say, just let me know, and I won't say it. And I'm like, no, Mags, like, they absolutely want to hear what you want to say. Like, you know, provide all this advice. It's only good. She's like, okay. I'll let them know what I think.
we had Vandenham on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he's still coming to grips with being the oldest guy out there and being a veteran. I was trying to tell him he's still in his 20s. It's okay. He's not old yet.
Well, and Vandenham, he loves to talk about this, because I don't know when I told this story, but at some point we were talking about, like, just putting in the work and just showing up every day and putting in the work, and eventually you're going to become a good pro. And I was on a tangent. And I was saying, like, take Michael, for example. Like, he was nothing spectacular as a junior. Like, he wasn't talented at all. And he just kept showing up year after year. And now look at him. He's one of the best racers in North America. And it wasn't meant to be, like, malicious at all. But he thinks it's the funniest thing in the world. Because, like, you definitely have your riders who are, they come with a pedigree. Like, Gunnar Holmgren has been a good rider since he's been quite young. His parents were both bike racers. His whole family races bikes. If you look at someone like Emma White, right, like, the whole family races bikes, you can kind of bank that they're going to be a good bike racer. But other riders, like, you know, Michael Vandenham is from Brandon, Manitoba. There aren't many bike racers from Brandon, Manitoba.
Yet, and, as we were discussing with him, still a Leafs fan.
God bless that man. They're a great team. Yeah, certainly he's just, like, Manitoba, for whatever reason, I still have not been able to crack the code, just punches above its weight for talent. Like, if you look at Tanya Dubnikov, Clara Hughes, I think Aaron Carter's from there. Michael Vandenham, Leah Kirchman, and then even, like, people like Adam Morka, Emily Batty's husband, is from Brandon, Manitoba. So they just have this really great, like, community coaching program and club program, and they get the kids out like a couple times a week riding bikes, and they have this old, it's not beat up, I don't want to make it sound bad, but this old, like, you know, GM van that they take to all the races, and there's always a Manitoba team at Nationals, there's always a Manitoba team at Mountain Bike Nationals, and it's just like keep chipping away at it, and it shows. And some of the riders, like there's a kid from Manitoba, Danick Vandal, who is phenomenal, and I wish he would race more. And he's doing a carpentry apprenticeship, but he's one of those kids that could, like, you know, probably do a season in Europe and be as good or better than any of the US U23s. Just good crit rider.
You know, we see it a little in the US, but, and this is something I was talking to Vandenham a little bit about, and I know we've had these conversations because it's still something that I think is more prevalent in Canada, is for you being the cyclocross manager, and you have these athletes who are amazing racers, but a good portion of them are, you know, first discipline mountain bike racers, and sort of that struggle to keep somebody like a rarity like Vandenham, who's like, I'm a cyclocross racer, even Mags now, who's like, I'm a cyclocross racer. But that's only recent that I think you would have Canadians who were, you know, when they said my discipline is cyclocross, and that still seems to be a struggle, still seems to be based on, you know, either karting or the Olympics and funding and everything else that comes into play there, which makes complete sense, but probably makes it even more difficult for your position to try to get people to buy into the sport.
And that's the discussion we're having right now, because if you look at the two biggest race series in Canada, they're Cross on the Rock, run by Norm Thibault, who's Wendy Sims' husband. Huge mass participation event on Vancouver Island. Tons of people show up for these cyclocross races. And then the VCCX, which is the Vancouver Cross Coalition. Again, huge numbers, and lots of kids coming up through the programming. But in Canada, like, it's a good, like, you know, I would say, like, it's well over 65-70% of the kids who race bikes in Canada don't have a funded national team. So downhill racers, cyclocross racers, enduro racers, and to a certain extent now BMX, like our funding is not as great with BMX as it used to be, even though it is an Olympic discipline. So, you know, there are going to be riders that come out, like, I don't know if Jen Jackson's a great example, but Jen kind of, you know, cut her teeth as a cross racer. She's raced mountain bikes, but kind of what put her on the map was cross. And but she also races mountain bike, and mountain biking is where the government money is, where you can get the karting, where you can get the funding. Like, the national team will provide funding for you to come over and race World Cups in Europe. Whereas even with cyclocross, we do a ton of fundraising. We have an amazing sponsorship group and people that just kind of every year give a couple thousand dollars each to support our programming. But I still have to charge, you know, even someone like Jen Jackson or Magalie, you know, it's still $1,000 or $1,500 to attend Worlds, because we don't receive government funding. And Cycling Canada is great in the sense that, you know, they lend us all the vans and they do all the booking for us, and they help offset costs any which way they can, but they don't have any targeted funding. And the way that the funding is ring fenced and so targeted, we can't access it. But you have riders that, you know, Magdalene Valliere Mill is a great example. There's a girl who as a junior, raced mountain bike worlds, road worlds, and cyclocross worlds in the same year. And she's probably going to end up as a road racer. She's a phenomenal little road racer. But I would like to think that, you know, the first national team project she ever went on was cyclocross worlds. And she spent the better part of, you know, 2 months over in Europe with us. And I'd like to think that kind of like being in the trenches, racing day in, day out, our program is very much run by mechanics. So we're not going to like fluff you up too much. It's very workmanlike. And I think going through that can only be a positive experience for some of those young riders before they get it like streamed into these programs that are more results based on an ongoing basis. You keep on having, you get this result, you move up to the next level, you get this result, you move up to the next level. Whereas cross, they've made the team, they're over in Europe. now their job is just to learn and get better. And I think with some of our younger riders, it's taken a couple of years. Like, I don't think Vandenham was anything special when he was younger, but he's really, really good right now. And I would put him in any race. It's like, you know, him and Curtis and Carey and Stephen Hyde fighting for the win. And I think Jen Jackson, same thing. She was good regionally, good provincially, and then, you know, has some breakout results and gets that confidence. She had a top 10 at the GP Sven Nyssen Ball the first year we brought her over, and then she rode that confidence to some strong results at the World Cups in North America. And I think so much of it at that level is confidence, and I think we were able to help her with some of that. And then even like Ruby West. Ruby has done junior or U23 women's worlds every year that it's been an option. And last year at worlds, she topped 10, if I'm correct. I think she got ninth. And that's just been a culmination of, you know, chipping away at it for 5 or 6 years. And I think this year could be a breakout year for her, just riding that confidence and riding that accumulated experience and putting it all together and kind of stepping into that where she's not fighting for a top five in North America. I think she's at the point where she's going to start fighting for that podium every weekend.
Yeah.
And I think it is absolutely awesome that if they were to resurrect the USGP cross series tomorrow, we would have three Canadian females fighting it out for the podium every single weekend, because other than Clara Hunsinger, and you know, a couple other ones, like, are, you know, Ruby, Jen, and Mags are super reliable in the fight every weekend. I think they're only going to get better.
Yeah. You said, I think I have to drink now, cause you brought up USGP.
Yeah. Is that a thing?
Well, no, cause it's what the question that people listening to this is, yeah, like, when's Bill going to ask Scott how he's going to save cyclocross? And then, you know, it always goes back to the
North USGP. American GP.
Well, this is the thing, and this, yeah, is actually something that I want to talk about with you, because you have an approach both in cyclocross and I think even starting just in mountain biking, and yeah, unfortunately the season that we missed, of how we could better structure races that really complement the best of both of our nations, especially since you know, with Norco and with all of the Canadian teams that come down to California early season. I mean, it's a huge contingent of racers down there.
And conversely, like when you have the Mont Tremblant Canada Cup, there's a huge contingent of American racers that come up to race it, because it's a C1 UCI race. And I just think it's absolutely asinine that we can't work together, Cycling Canada and USA Cycling, and have a North American series. And it could start in California, and we could do Fontana and Benelli, or Benelli and Temecula, or whatever. Like the guys at the Big Bear Racing, they're phenomenal. They've been running races in California for years. The kind of knowledge that they bring to the table that they could bring to a North American series would be great in terms of operations. And their major funding partner, ShowAir, is a transportation company. So when you go to those races, they have the big 18-wheeler truck set up with the big stage, and it's phenomenal. It's not a reach for me to say, okay, why can't we bring that truck then out east or up north? So in my mind, it's like racing starts in March, have two races in California, then move to those traditional May-June races. Please, for the love of God, don't make them conflict with the World Cups, or no one will show up. But have a North American GP, if you will, in Tremblant, and have one in Baie St. Paul, or have one in Vermont. They're all locations we can alternate throughout the year, and then move out west later in the summer in August, maybe leading into Crankworx or something like that, and have a race in Washington State or Oregon and BC, or Missoula and Canmore. They're not that far apart. And I think the strength of something like the Swiss cups is every single one of those Swiss C1s or HCs can become a World Cup tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I think to a certain extent, like, you know, Tremblant, you could make a World Cup out of it. And I think to a certain extent, you know, Benelli, I mean, that's already, I think, the location for the LA Olympics. It's got the infrastructure. But if you need the... You need the people who are racing it on the Saturday. You need the masters, right? So you need all the masters to want to show up to this overall series.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily need to throw prize money at them, but you need to throw a race that's interesting at them. And I know a ton of 30 to 39 and 40 to 49 year old folks that if they were chasing an overall series with points, there's some bragging, right? They're at the point where they now have the money that they can maybe chase a project like this. And it doesn't necessarily need to be Olympic format racing. I don't think that there's folks that are 40 to 45 that want to go out and race an hour hard, maybe make it a 2 hour race. Like they remember when they were kids, they can be nostalgic. And then on, and maybe have the short track on the Saturday and then on the Sunday, have the Olympic race or vice versa or whatever. But I think if you have a big event, the teams want to be there. The marketing folks want to be there.
I mean, throw Sea Otter in there too when you're in that California.
Absolutely. You know, and so you create the race that brings all the racers, that brings all the team, that brings all the sponsorship. But you need to have that masters component to it. You need to have that grassroots. So there needs to be some kids races, and you need to have that Olympic cross country format. And I mean, for a race like Benelli, we're set up on the Wednesday anyway. So to me, it's not that huge a reach to have, like, you know, short track on a Friday, but maybe like the folks who are masters racers would race on the Sunday or something like that because they can't get off work. But to me, the two competing series just seems silly. I think Canada has a lot to offer. I think we have a huge history in the bike industry, whether it's Norco or Rocky or Da Vinci or Argon or Cycles Lambert or whomever. And I think there are a lot of, you know, Canadians in management positions at American companies. We within the bike industry move from American company to Canadian company quite easily. And I think the bike racers, the Canadians race in the US and the Americans race in Canada, to me, like having a premier North American series, that to me is the answer.
Yeah.
I know there is absolutely a price tag associated with that, but all these races are happening already. So to me, it's like, take the six or eight best that don't conflict with World Cups, call it a series, find a title sponsor. They're all doing their own independent thing. They all have to like live up to certain UCI standards anyways. I'm sure there's someone in the industry that thinks that's worth, you know, $10,000 overall, and go from there.
Yeah. It's the thing that I like about that is that, you know, the biggest like money series that we have in the US now for mountain biking would be Epic Rides. And that's more, what would now be considered marathon, even though it's, you know, 3 hours for those guys to get through those races, is that we don't have that just dedicated, as you know, Olympic XCO duration that is what, you know, what you need for that's the World Cup, that's the Olympics, that's everything. And also I think that is the most exciting racing out there. I mean, I think it's the most exciting format. People can either attribute or blame Red Bull for bringing mountain biking to what it looks like today. But I'm one of those people who's like, this is much more exciting than seeing people go off into the woods for 3 hours and coming back.
But think about like using Epic Rides, for example. I think like some of the most exciting races of the year are the fat tire crits at the Epic Rides.
Sure.
And it's because they've timed those to coincide with the master's registration and the meeting that they have to do the day before.
Right.
So the night before the master's races on the Saturday, you have this big festival, you have bands out, and you have the pros racing a fat tire crit. And it is an amazing environment. It's awesome. There's almost more people for the fat tire crit than there are for the
finish. Yeah. And that's the draw for the cities. I mean, that's why they want that. And then it just sort of bleeds into the rest of the weekend. And I think you saw that. That's why I love short track. I mean, I think the short track possibilities at these other races is great.
And I think the key is the grassroots as well. It's the younger kids. It's the Nike kids. Like, I have been to so many autograph signings at Interbike where, you know, a certain brand will kind of pull a couple of their key athletes out and they'll put them at a table and they'll have some posters and like a couple of guys from the bike shop will show up, but mostly there'll be crickets. And I remember this past year at Nationals at Hardwood Hills, we had an autograph signing and we didn't even do a great job of advertising it, to be completely honest. Like, we basically just said, you know, show up between 1 and 2 and the Norco Factory team is going to be there signing autographs. And we had some posters and the line of kids was just phenomenal. And I've heard it a couple times since then. I've seen kids out with their jerseys on and like, you know, it's a completely different brand. It might be like Trek or something, but like, you know, Haley Smith's name is autographed on the shoulder. And I think that's like, I still remember when I was a kid racing and Chrissy Redden came out to one of our kind of like Wednesday night races and she kind of rode the pre-ride with all of us. And I remember at the time she was racing for Richie and she had the first like 2x9 set up before, like it was still 8-speed transitioning into 9-speed, but she had a 2x9 that was only on the Richie bikes. And I remember going home and like taking the granny ring off my chain ring and just thinking it was the coolest thing in the world. I didn't reset my limit screws at all. So I think the first thing I did was like throw it into the frame. But I just remember just thinking that was badass. And you can't kind of put a price or quantify like that aspirational aspect. And so anything you do in terms of series, you have to provide racing opportunities for the elites that need the UCI points to compete in Europe for start position. You need to provide an opportunity for masters to come out and race a little bit longer than, you know, than we've been forcing them to race. They want to race 2 hours. If they're going to pay $75 or $80 to race a race, make it worth their while. Have a big atmosphere, have a beer tent, have a barbecue, the whole family can come out, but then have those like those little pseudo short track races for the kids that are coincided to end right before the short track starts, right? So like when the elites are racing, the kids can go, wow. And the masters can go, wow. And I think that ultimately is going to be something that's tangible for the sponsors.
Yeah. Yeah. No, short track has been awesome. 20 minutes and three laps, just it's perfect timing. And then you just get some fun dynamic racing. So that was all good. And that's a nice little warm up. To the bigger problem at hand.
Yes.
Scott Kelly.
Yeah.
How do you fix North American cyclocross?
Well, this is the debate that we were having today, and we were kind of reaching out to Uncle Jeff for his answer. I think it's a tough one because first, I come from a racing background. I work for race teams. So my first answer is obviously, you know, we need a proper race series. And I think that is an answer. The schedule as it is has people just like a sponsor can't wrap their mind around paying for someone to go to like Gloucester one weekend, then all the way to Oklahoma the next weekend, then all the way to, Midland, Ontario the next weekend. Like it just doesn't make sense. Like there has to be some thought towards like the mountain bike schedule does, where you have a Temecula and a Benelli back to back. So and then the World Cup schedule does the same thing, right? Like you have more or less two races that you can fly over and you can do a 14-day block and you can hit two World Cups at the same
time. For mountain biking.
Nice. So I think the answer for cyclocross is the same. Like you need to make it to make sense in terms of logistics, first and foremost. I think there needs to be something there for everyone again. If you look at U.S. Nationals, like look at how popular U.S. Nationals are. That's huge. Mm-hmm. Why they can't replicate something like that to a smaller extent 5 or 6 times a year like the USGP used to do? Like, were you at the Worlds in Kentucky?
Yeah.
The amount of masters riding around in that muddy field, like, that master's course was possibly the worst thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Like it was an afterthought. And people were loving it. So if you build it, they will come.
A flat field and one berm.
Correct. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have with Masters racing in Canada, at least, is how do you, it's the season long narrative. If you're the BC provincial champ and you have the Ontario provincial champ and you have one guy who's, or one lady who's podiumed 10 years in a row in 40 to 49, how do you seed them? How do you start them? You need a year-long kind of ranking to make that narrative make sense, building up to nationals, right? So I think there's enough people that race cyclocross that if you could create that series, create that NFL, like, you know, going into week eight, you know, so-and-so is leading so-and-so, who's going to come out on top going into nationals, it creates something that people can kind of sink their teeth into. That to me is one of the solutions. I think the other thing that like is coming up is gravel racing, right? And I think that's the discussion that we were having today offline is, you know, if you're a dedicated cross racer, you need to do, for the most part, as a North American, you need to do something else. You need to race mountain bike, or you need to be a crit racer, or you need to race gravel. And gravel has been this great kind of addition to cross racing in the sense that most of, you know, the Magalie Rochettes of the world and the Stephen Hydes of the world are doing long rides in the middle of the summer. So it's like, well, let's go out and do this big, long, crazy gravel epic because I'm going to be riding 5 hours that day anyways. And I don't know that that necessarily saves cyclocross, but it provides a little bit more support from a industry sense for those riders. Like, I think it's something now where you can say, you know, I'm a drop bar adventure rider. You see Rebecca Feringer out doing these like cool gravel races in Oregon and then parlaying that fitness into like a breakout season last year, quite frankly, in cyclocross. Right. So I think it's making our North American riders a little bit more legitimate. But again, I think it just comes down to it. You need that series. You need something that people can wrap their mind around, that there's a progression throughout the season, that you can sign up as a kid, you race junior, you move up to Espoir, you move up to Elite, you move up to Masters 30 to 39. Cycling is a really complicated sport for parents to get their kids into. Like, it doesn't make sense to most people. So I bought my kid a bike and I want to sign him up for cycling, but it turns out my local club's a road racing club and I bought them a mountain bike. Yeah. So now I need to buy them a road racing bike. And there's nothing to show you at the outset. It's not like you buy a set of hockey skates and you sign up for hockey and you start as Tyke and you move up to Adam and you maybe you're good. So then you move to a rep team or a AAA team or whatnot. Like, it's just really, really, we do such a good job of making cycling so complicated for people trying to get into it. And I think for most people, like, there's a competitive sense. You sign up for, like, you know, beer league softball, but there's still a season and some playoffs.
Right.
And I think that's what we need to do a better job of, is just make it really easy for people to understand the narrative of the season and get behind kind of the plot.
So let's talk about the top tier, the elites.
Okay.
And making something that everybody can sort of glom onto, and there's a narrative to it, and I guess my question to start with is, should we, the things that I hear, one is that the country or even our the continent is too big, so for what cyclocross racers make, it's a huge burden for them expense wise to go, as you said, logistically it's weird, but even without that, you know, you're working your way across the country. When do you go home? When do you work? When do you make other money? Whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you have, you know, we had the point, and it's constricted a little bit, but we had the point a couple of years ago where we had 40 UCI races in North America,
which is silly,
where you had some weekends with our talent pool that was split three ways. And that doesn't interest me. I mean, I want to see all of them racing against each other. So what is it a shorter, do we need a shorter season? Do we need a dedicated season? I think calling something people get stuck on this national series. I don't think it's a national series, but you need something where you are earmarking races and saying, this is where we are going to meet. This is where we are going to bash each other's heads in to make it possible for us to go to Europe and actually compete. And that's what I think we've been struggling with to find since the USGP went away.
And that kind of happened to a certain extent when like the C1s became like the de facto yes. series. So you had these like five or six big races. You had Cincy, you had Jingle Cross, you had like, you know, the big races where everyone showed up. And it wasn't a series, but it was.
And that's the thing. And everybody, and that's exactly the thing that I think when we look back on it, that we all were still, when that was happening, it was still, so 2012 was the end of USGP. And then you had that coming in like 2014, 2015 on, you had up to like eight C1s. And we're all like, it's, yes, that's a de facto series, but we don't want to think as a series. We need something else that's going to replace the USGP. But looking back on it, that was it, right?
Well, but if you took the C1s and you, as simple as saying, okay, there's going to be eight weekends that we allow C1s in North America, plus nationals, plus Pan American Championships. So there's 10 weekends, and we're going to date protect those weekends. So if you have a C1, if you are an organizer that can get the money to support that prize purse, if you can get all the sponsors, if you can build the infrastructure that supports a C1 race like Cincy, we are going to protect that weekend for you. We're not going to double book you with a C2, because there's always going to be someone that's going to go to the C2 for that like hope at getting like fifth and getting that one point that allows them to like do whatever.
Right.
And I think that's a race to the bottom. I think as North Americans, we need to, you know, think about what we want that series to be, cherry pick some of the best races, go to some of the best organizers and go, hey, listen, like, you know what, you've been a really, really great organizer and you've done a phenomenal job for the last like X amount of years. We want to help you be a C1. We want to protect that weekend. So we're going to protect your investment of time and your sponsors' investments of money. And we know that if this is a protected C1 weekend, we can show that X amount of people are going to show up. And then you have to take all those different organizers, like specific concerns. So obviously, you know, maybe the park that they use is only available this one weekend. Okay. That's a constraint on your time. And, you know, I know that my race does best on this weekend. So you look at it all, you look at the geographical concerns, you're never going to make everyone happy, but you can probably do a pretty good compromise that's going to create a series that A, has points, B, has sponsorship, C, has it's logistically makes sense for teams. And that's when you start to build momentum. You add the masters components, because I think the organizers, and I don't organize races, so I don't know this for sure, but I suspect that the organizers make the majority of their money on masters racers.
Oh, for sure. I love masters racers.
And the margin's bigger, right? Because you don't need to pay them the same amount of prize money. So
or any prize money at all, which they shouldn't be getting. Give them,
you know. Totally. if we can do things like that, but like even like we as a part of the Canadian program have a little bit of, our working group has a little bit of say into dates and to when nationals is going to be and who nationals is going to be. And 9 times out of 10 in Canada, I'm banging my head against a wall because I'm like, okay, please, like for the love of God, do not double book Iceman Cometh. Like just, it's on the schedule a year in advance. We know when the Iceman is going to be. It is the biggest point-to-point mountain bike race in North America. Don't put cross nationals the same weekend or you're going to lose Jeff Kabush. You're going to lose Pete DeSera. You're going to lose Catherine Pendrell because they're paid primarily as mountain bikers, right? That's all in Canada that we have to do to make cross nationals a success is not to double book it with Iceman.
Yeah.
And it just takes a bit of like, in-house knowledge. And I think sometimes that like, you know, event, and this isn't to sound bad because I know that the event managers at USA Cycling and Cycling Canada are very, very good people, but it's like you have to know if you're going to double book Iceman, you're going to lose half the elite field. And yes, it's just the elite field, but then you lose the aspirational aspect and you lose, like, you know, if Jeff Kabush isn't going to the race, well, then his truck and trailer and the whole nine yards isn't going. And if Pete DeSera isn't going to the race, well, we're probably not going to send the whole truck and trailer either, right? So then the venue's half the size, and then you lose that kind of whole Nationals vibe and feel. And I think that's where, like, I would love to sit down with Jesse Anthony and, you know, Josh Peacock, who's our organizing events guy at Cycling Canada, and sit down with the U.S. representative and sit down with Brooke Watts and just, like, have an empty calendar and put our pieces together and ignore Europe. Like, say, this is what's best for North America. And we even had it this year. Like, we were talking about dates with Nationals, and we said, you know what, the best Nationals date is unfortunately going to conflict with Coxside. So I said, let me take it to the athletes. So I went to Vandenham and I went to Magalie because it's the only two people it realistically affects. And I said, hey guys, Nationals or Coxside? And they're like, yeah, Nationals. So, like, we have that discussion that's happening a year in advance, so it doesn't catch everyone by surprise. And it's so easy to do. It took me 2 seconds to eliminate that as a potential source of conflict. And I don't think those conversations necessarily happen enough. How hard is it for USA Cycling to call up Stu Thorne and say, hey, we're thinking about this date. Yay, nay, concerns.
Yeah. I think the biggest one too is Pan Am's should be a protected date. I mean, like, the whole Pan Am's NoHo thing was just, I mean, it just sucked. Nobody wins in that kind of stuff, you know?
Pan Am's is interesting to me, and, like, I'm going to risk, like, shooting myself in the foot over this one, but, like, I think it's been awesome that it's been in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was awesome when it was in Cincy. I think, Kopachi, obviously, they give North America cross Pan Ams because, you know, that it's less likely that we're going to want to run road Pan Ams or track Pan Ams, right, or what, right, that kind of thing. And Kopachi, for those who don't know, is kind of like the League of Nations. Like, every country has a vote. And there's three of us in North America and a bunch in South America. And so we're kind of free to do what we want with cross Pan Ams. But I don't think the process by which cross Pan Ams has been handed out, and maybe even to a certain extent, and again, I don't know for sure, but I think the World Cups and I think cross Pan Ams, I don't think they've been handed out in the most equitable and transparent of manners. And I don't think that creates trust amongst the organizers that would be interested and capable of running Pan Ams or track world or cross World Cups. So, you know, put me on the cross, but that's my opinion.
All right.
You can debate that later.
All right. So we are right at an hour, I want to call this almost like part one, because I can, as you know, Scott, we spent a lot of time together. We could sit here and have this conversation for the next seven hours.
I'd like to have a whole podcast with you where we just rank our favorite movies, favorite musicians, and favorite beers.
Absolutely. Let's do it. Let's come back and do that. That'd be
something. Or do a live podcast from the streets of Madison, Wisconsin, where we're killing time between the two World Cups.
I was thinking back on our week between World Cups, cyclocross World Cups, and man, that was a, there were some hard mornings in there, but that was a that was a darn good week.
Well, we were, you know, it was one of those things. We were celebrating the successes of Iowa. Obviously, it's been I think Lynn Bissette was the last Canadian to win a World Cup in May. So obviously that was a great weekend. And then we were already celebrating the successes of the next weekend because Katarina won, and that was a good weekend for Cliff.
Exactly. So, yeah.
It was a good week all around.
Absolutely. All right. Hey, Scott, thanks so much for doing this. As I said, you know, I think there's a ton more that we can talk about and just sort of scratching the surface here with your knowledge. But I love, as you know, I'm a big fan of Canadian cycling and all that you do. So I'm glad that we're finally to get this down on tape.
Well, awesome. Thanks for having me.
The Slow Ride Podcast, three idiots who are usually wrong.
The Slow Ride Podcast, the titanium of podcasts.
The Slow Ride Podcast. It's like if David Vanderpool had a podcast.
The Slow Ride Podcast, the Zwift Racing of podcasts.
The Slow Ride Podcast, find the real advice.
The Slow Ride Podcast, the Arrow Helmet of podcasts.
The Slow Ride Podcast, sport leader coming through.
The Slow Ride Podcast, when's Lance gonna sue us?
The Slow Ride Podcast, the experts in French cycling.
The Slow Ride Podcast, official fan experience zone on Facebook.
The Slow Ride Podcast, the gravel bike of podcasts.
The Slow Ride Podcast, both vertically and horizontally compliant.
The Slow Ride Podcast. New episodes every Tuesday.